Hi, everybody. I'm Julie Rack. So, you know, just quiet down. I'm a professor in the English and Film Studies Department here at the University of Alberta. And it is my special pleasure to introduce Daniel Coleman to you today, since Daniel is a good friend of mine, and I'm sure he is many of you. This event has been co-sponsored by the Religious Studies Program at the University of Alberta, and also by the Runing Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life. It is also made possible through the Hendrickson Memorial Endowment Fund. A little bit more about the Runing Center. It is run under the auspices of Augustana College, and now, because Augustana is part of the University of Alberta, it is also part of the larger institution. The center has sponsored more than 100 public events last year, including philosophers' cafes, lectures, and conferences, and it reaches close to an amazing 4,000 people. Its mission is to nurture, on its website it says, a hospitable context that brings forward the finest thinking of women and men of faith and the depth and texture of their traditions in conversation with public intellectuals and various secular ideologies. It is an ideal organization to sponsor Daniel Coleman, since Daniel himself is a person of deep faith who seeks to dialogue with others in academia and in the public sphere about political, spiritual, and ethical issues, especially those to do with injustices based on cultural difference. Daniel did his PhD at the University of Alberta, and he also did a postdoc here. Good thing he likes to ski. So this is a homecoming of sorts for him and for us, and I hope you brought your skis. Daniel is a professor in the Department of English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University, where he holds a Canada Research Chair in Diversity and Literary Cultures. He is the author of a number of scholarly and creative non-fictional books, including Masculine Migrations, Reading the Postcolonial Mill in New Canadian Narratives, The Scent of Eucalyptus, A Missionary Childhood, which is a memoir by him, and it's about Ethiopia, and that book is the winner of a Hamilton Literary Arts Prize for nonfiction in 2004. He is also the author of White Civility, the Literary Project of English Canada, which was the winner of the Raymond Klebanski Prize for the best book in the humanities, sponsored by the ASPP, and that was in 2007. And, of course, he has written and published the book we'll be hearing about today, In Bed with a Word, Reading Spirituality and Cultural Politics. That was published with the University of Alberta Press in 2009, and as you can see, it is directly available from them after this event. So please get your copy if you have not got one already. Daniel is also the editor of a number of special issues and book collections about Canada and cultural diversity issues, many of them in collaboration with newer scholars. And many of these books have been generated under the auspices of his Canada Research Chair Symposium for Diversity in Canadian Literary Cultures. It's a mouthful, but it's interesting. It has exciting scholarly network possibilities, and it is located at McMaster University. The network is dedicated to exploring issues connected to indigeneity, migration, and cultural diversity in Canada. One of the hallmarks of Daniel's work has been his refusal to keep scholarly inquiry and his personal beliefs and occupations separate. Daniel has opened to us his personal life, faith, and private thoughts about everything from racism to hair loss, to migration and displacement, to the meaning of collaboration in groups, to what it means to be an ethical person right now. He has told stories about himself that not only illuminate the arguments he makes, but which also make public difficult questions about cultural difference, whiteness, the meaning of religion in a secular world, and whether literature has the power to be a public voice in the ongoing development of Canada as a state and as a nation. We are fortunate to have him among us as he talks to us about what it could mean to read publicly. And so please join me in welcoming Dr. Daniel Coleman, whose talk is titled Reading Beyond the Book, Reader as Public Intellectual.
It's such an honor to be introduced by Julie, who we've kind of had this tag team relationship for a long time, and she welcomed me to Hamilton in 1997. I got to be on her committee for a little while, which gave me a chance to learn her project and the really sharp mind that she has, and to celebrate that she then arrived here at Edmonton that I knew so well. We gave, you know, one another, here's maps to the city, here's good places to get your hair cut and find a dentist and stuff like that. So these kinds of exchanges are very practically helpful as well as good for the soul. And it's a blast from the past to be in this room speaking. As Julie said, I did a PhD here and a postdoctoral fellowship, and they are some of the fondest memories I have. I made close friends, mentors, colleagues here, and you have remained really important in my life from those days till now. So it's with a deep sense of gratitude that I'm here, and delighted to be able to share with you some of the things I'm thinking about of late. I have about a million people to acknowledge and thank here, and we could just do that all afternoon, but probably you came to hear the talk, so I will just offer some particular thanks. First, I'd like to acknowledge the Plains Cree, Woodland Cree, and Assiniboine peoples whose signatures on Treaty 6 made it possible for us to be here today. This thanks comes with the sincere hope that the principles of Myosetawin, good relations, and Wetaskiwin, living together in the land, become broadly shared among all who live here in their traditional territory. I'd like to thank David Goa, director of the Chester Looning. I didn't know there was an umlaut over the O. This is the first time I figured out how to pronounce, heard it pronounced properly. Chester Looning Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life at the University of Alberta, for inviting me to be here today and to share these ideas with you. And I'd also like to thank Rebecca Warren, the executive assistant with the Rooning Center, for making sure I was in the right place at the right time and communicating with me in such a warm and pleasant way. As I said earlier, I owe a great deal to the University of Alberta, where I did my studies. Many of the relationships that inform and sustain me to this day were formed here. Finally, the lecture I'm presenting today grows out of the book I published with the University of Alberta Press, and I have to say that working with the U of A Press has been such a pleasure. The dynamism of the team, the way they like working with you, not about you, when you're producing a book, the incredible beauty of design that the designers at that press make have just made my experience working with the U of A Press a real pleasure. So, to the talk. This lecture grows out of the work I did on In Bed with the Word, but it isn't the material in the book, so if you're interested in the book, you just have to buy it. This comes out of thinking I've done since that project was formalized into between those covers. And it comes out of a request I received to write a piece from that reading project for a book called Hope and the Public Intellectual. So if you hear me using the term public intellectual and hope, it comes because I was thinking in relation to this book project. Most people think of the public intellectual as a person. The problem with this notion is that it pins too much hope for social change on the image of the romantic hero. Some really smart or specially gifted person will emerge organically out of the ranks of the populace. Just as Antonio Gramsci said in his original description of the public intellectual, this person will articulate the conditions of our lives in such a way as to galvanize us all into social action and revolutionary change. I don't dispute that such people have emerged in human history, but it's pretty rare. It seems to me that you have to wait a long time for conditions to converge so that a Gandhi or an Edward Said or a Nelson Mandela can galvanize a movement for positive change. So I'm interested here in where we might find hope in the meantime, in the less romantic and less personality-driven possibilities. I'd like to suggest that if we think of public intellectualism as a set of activities rather than as a person, activities that most people may already participate in or have the inclination to participate in, then perhaps we might be able to concentrate on the potentials within their activities for invigorating public life and addressing immense and seemingly intractable problems. Very simply, I submit that reading, plain and simple, but understood in broader terms than we often do, is significant public intellectual activity. Or to put it the other way around, reading is a fundamental activity of the public intellectual. This claim may seem strange because reading seems decidedly unpublic, since most of us do it in private. It is precisely in the paradox of its privacy, however, that we can find its potential. For reading is an activity that causes us to retreat from others in order to connect with them. Think about what happens when we read. We isolate ourselves with the words of the text, but we do so to attend to the thoughts and images generated by someone else. So our isolation when we read is not solipsistic. Indeed, the privacy of reading fosters a unique vulnerability. We can open ourselves to the experiences and views of others without fear of immediate evaluation by them. We can try on unfamiliar ideas or behaviors offstage, as it were, before we decide how they fit our public lives. Solitary reading is then, despite appearances, the scene of our active engagement with others, with worlds beyond our own immediate surroundings. This paradox makes reading profoundly intimate and private on the one hand, and publicly socially active on the other. For readers cannot passively consume a text, but must imagine a dialogue with the usually absent author to construct meaning, image, and understanding. Seen from this angle, reading constitutes a posture of attentiveness. It exercises our skills as active interpreters and counteracts the temptation to remain passive consumers and private ones. I've developed these ideas at length in the book In Bed with the Word, so I want to move on to a second paradox, which is that reading is also not a non-consumptive kind of consumption that engages the other even as it leaves the other untouched. In the words of the poet and translator Robert Bringhurst, reading enables us to reach across the fence between the world and ourselves without destroying what we find. Reading in this sense eats without killing, harvests without cutting, takes interest without usury. The things we read, whether a newspaper, a human face, or the needles of a pine tree, nourish us and survive us. Rightly, Bringhurst locates this activity in the economy of consumption. It may not seem so in the restaurant or the bookstore, he writes, but we know it works both ways, being fed and feeding, reading and being read. To stay alive, we must consume. We must eat the lives of others, plants, minerals, animals, and eventually we too become the food of others when our bodies return to the earth. Reading is a great relief, because in a sense, it's one step removed from this necessary economy. Like eating, reading reveals our interdependency on the world around us. We depend upon others for the words in our own mouths, for our mental nourishment, just as they depend on us. But reading is to consume without consuming. The object being read lives on after our reading, has its own life, retains its individuality even after we have ingested it. The activity of reading, then, is a beam of hope in times when it seems there is no escaping the pandemic of consumption that characterizes our history and culture. In the early 19th century, 1 in 4 British people died of consumption. A century later, it was 1 in 6 in France. The disease was called consumption because at that time people believed it was an internal disease, one that caused humans to be consumed from within, much as we now understand cancer. Among some European elites, the disease was viewed with tragic fascination. A consumptive woman might become radiant. A consumptive artist might have remarkable strokes of genius just before he died. Think of John Keats. For the underclass, however, there were no such romantic illusions. They coughed up blood and they died. They died in the millions and not just in Europe. In 1880, new knowledge about germs gave the disease a new name, tuberculosis, and taught that it spread rapidly in the very air you breathed. with your neighbors. So it changed from being an internal to being a highly social disease, and it had global killing power. When Columbus stumbled into the Caribbean at the end of the 15th century, there were an estimated 7 to 10 million people on Turtle Island north of the Rio Grande. There were only 350,000 left at the end of the 19th century. During these 400 years, tuberculosis, among other urban diseases of the European poor, decimated the population of indigenous peoples in North America by 95%. It would be no exaggeration to say that European imperial power was spread by consumption, commercial and corporeal. And it isn't over yet. The colonization is still at fever pitch, Bringhurst writes. The great transformation of gold into lead and of forests into shopping malls continues. Indeed, it continues at such a pace that it seems we can turn anything, including reading, into a consumptive activity. When we compulsively line our walls with books we never actually read, or when we completely colonize the words of others so that we forget they were produced by someone outside of our own egos. If anything breeds cynicism in our times, it's the despair that whatever we humans do, we consume and destroy the world around us. Our ingenuity to provide for our immediate comfort depends upon what we brazenly call non-renewable resources. It's worth reminding ourselves that non-renewable means our dependence on them is unsustainable. Our homes are heated by natural gas drawn from shallower and shallower wells that siphon this volatile liquid from pockets in the earth whose stability and extent we actually don't know. The gasoline we burn in our automobiles derives from oil that we will go to war against humans and nature to secure. Whether the cost is the lives of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, British, Americans, and others between 1990 and 2011, or whether it's the life of the ecosystem in the Gulf of Mexico after 100 million gallons of crude were spilled into the sea by British Petroleum's malfunctioning Deepwater Horizon well in 2010, we are willing to expend these lives so that we can drive to the store and pack our purchases in plastic bags. In a culture that gauges its economic health by measures such as the Consumer Confidence Index, the inevitability of our consumption can cause us to lose hope in ourselves. We are tempted to give in, knowing that in the end we are consuming ourselves, our own futures. Perhaps we may glow more beautifully or have one last flash of genius before we expire. There are those who try, at least, to resist. Whether they stop eating meat or join a carpool or take the bus, whether they install solar heating or turn off the air conditioner, whether they plant a vegetable garden or try to bring food and medical aid to victims of oil wars in Sudan and Iraq, they refuse the cynicism of consumption. They can imagine a relation to the other that is non-consumptive, that sees the other as having a life, a subjectivity, a being that is as rich and precious and complex as their own. And they want to nourish that life, to make sure it thrives, because they know they are interdependent with it. These are people who have not lost hope, who wish to respect the world around them, to engage the world without destroying what they touch. But it seems the larger focus or forces in our culture press unstintingly towards bigger box stores, faster microprocessors, larger television screens, and extra lanes on the highway. In a culture of impatient consumption, one wonders if there is any hope for reading in the private, let alone public, intellectual life it makes possible. There are those who have been driven by this despair to hunker down in defense of the traditional book. They see the culture of the screen as the enemy, whether it's TV with its laugh tracks and advertising, its surround sound and high definition knockout punch, or whether it's the high speed commerce saturated internet with its chimes and click me pop-ups, tweets and Twitters, and the culture of the screen seems opposed to the posture of sustained attention associated with the printed page. The hope I see in reading, however, lies not so much in the medium itself as in the paradoxes of privacy in order to connect, and consuming not to consume, that I think is its essential value. Let me illustrate what I mean by reading beyond the book, by reading a text that is not a printed document, that has circulated widely in North America for about four centuries. It's a dry cold here. Around 1613, two peoples found themselves thrown together in the same territory and on the same river by the burgeoning forces of colonial consumption. Dutch traders had traveled up what was later called the Hudson River into Haudenosaunee territory. The Haudenosaunee were and are a confederacy of the first five and then six Iroquois and language-speaking nations, the Mohawks, Oneidas, Onondagas, Cayugas, and Senecas, who were eventually joined in the 18th century by the Tuscaroras. When the Dutch arrived in Haudenosaunee territory in what is now upstate New York, they marveled at the densely populated towns, the fertile fields tall with the corn that sheltered rich crops of beans and squash, corn. They eyed the forests of oak, sugar maples, and tall, straight trunks of the white pines that would make perfect ship masts. They gazed at the soft leather leggings and moccasins worn by the people and tried to gauge how many beaver pelts might be found around here. The sachems, or lords of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy Council, along with clan mothers, warriors, and consultants, greeted the newcomers, and rather than overwhelming their ship and confiscating their goods, or requiring them to abandon their language and enter schools where they could be civilized and taught the rudiments of consultative democracy, they formed a friendship with them. For the Haudenosaunee, too, saw advantages in the arrival of these newcomers, who would take pelts and hides in exchange for iron-headed axes, guns, and metal cooking pots. After the two groups had become acquainted with each other, the time came for the Haudenosaunee to formalize this friendship. They therefore showed the Dutch traders a ceremonial belt of purple and white quahog shell beads called wampum. Wampum was part of a widespread, mutually intelligible system of graphical communication that extended across and between early Amerindian cultures, from the Tupi-Guarani, Aivu, Rapita, or origin of human speech, to the Yucatec Mayan paper screenfolds, to the Algonquian Walamolom, or red score, Madewin, or grand medicine scrolls, and Mi'kmaq hieroglyphics. With its ideographical patterns woven into strings or belts, wampum was a common communication medium throughout the northeastern region of Turtle Island. Among the Iroquois, it was used as a ceremonial mnemonic system for communicating agreements between peoples. For the accounts I have heard of the meeting of the Dutch and the Haudenosaunee come from oral history that have found their way into written form. The version I know best comes from a couple of articles written by Tuscarora scholar Richard Hill, who lives about half an hour from where I live in Hamilton, and who recounts the story as he heard it from Jacob Thomas, who's in the PowerPoint slide up there, an elder Cayuga chief, now deceased, who was an adjunct professor at Trent University, and whose father had become who had been a wampum keeper, and from Huron Miller, a respected Onondaga culture bearer. The belt the Haudenosaunee brought in ceremony to the Dutch is called the Aderiwasonsera Gaswanta, or in English, the two-row wampum. Because two rows of purple beads run horizontally across the belt, uniformly parallel, so they never veer apart nor merge together into one. The two purple rows divide the belt into the three background rows of white beads, each three beads wide. The Haudenosaunee pointed to the white beads and explained that they represented the river the Dutch had been sailing on. The river was the Creator's gift to all people, including two-legged ones such as the Haudenosaunee and the Dutch. It provided them with much of their livelihood and it gave them ease of travel. They then pointed to the two rows and explained that one row represented the Dutch sailing vessel, while the other represented the Iroquoian canoe. They would share the Creator's river, neither interfering with the other's progress nor boarding the other's vessel. This is how to conduct a friendship in this place, they said. The parties would share the water and the life sustained by it, especially when they remembered that the three bands of white beads on which the two vessels floated represented the three principles of peace, friendship, and respect. Dutch traders did not understand what they were hearing. How could they? Everything they'd been taught about the people they would encounter in the Americas insisted they were illiterate, savages with no civilization, no government, no God, no morals. They were utterly unprepared for the Aderiwasonsera, Gaswenta, with its sophisticated iconography of equity, autonomy, interrelationship, and ecological responsibility. They did not know how to read this kind of text. So, like most people would do, they translated it into their own notions of how to sweeten talks with people you've just met and who sit on resources you'd like to extract. They expressed their family respect for the Haudenosaunee and their beliefs in what they said, and they said, henceforth, we'll call you our sons. The Haudenosaunee had had some of their men up near Stadacona, now known as Quebec City, forcibly adopted 80 years earlier and taken to France by Jacques Cartier's sailing ships, never to be seen again. So they covered their alarm at this delightful proposal with diplomatic calm. We respect you and your beliefs and what you say, said the Haudenosaunee, but you pronounced yourselves as our father, and this we do not agree with, because the father can tell his son what to do and can punish his son. We suggest we call each other brother. The Dutch, needing to establish friendly terms with the people who govern the region, agreed. And to indicate their understanding of the serious intent of this Council of Friendship, they offered to put our friendship in writing. Haudenosaunee replied, well, this is good, but one thing we must remember, paper doesn't really last so well. We must find a way to make sure that the friendship will be passed on to the next generation. The Haudenosaunee had shown the Dutch a durable, long-lasting, easy-to-read iconographic representation of their relationship in the two-row. So the Dutch replied with a symbolic object of their own, a chain of three links, representing friendship, a good mind, and peace. This chain would represent the binding of the two peoples together. As it was made of iron, it would need to be cleaned and polished to keep away rust, just as any friendship needs review and renewal. There's a whole long other story about the what became the Silver Covenant chain that I'm going to skip out here. The Dutch then affirmed, what you have said, and this we shall always remember, what we do about our own ways of belief, we shall both respect, having our own rights and power. To which the Haudenosaunee replied with this explanation of the Aderi Wison Serra Gaswenta. I have a canoe, and you have a vessel with sails, and this is what we shall do. I will put in my canoe my beliefs and laws, and in your vessel you should put your beliefs and laws. All my people will be in my canoe, and your people will be in your vessel. We shall put these boats in the water, and they shall always be parallel. As long as there is Mother Earth, this will be everlasting. Then the Dutch had a question. What will happen if your people like to go on my vessel? The Haudenosaunee answered, if this happens, they'll have to be guided by my canoe. But the Dutch raised another problem. What will happen if any of our people may someday want to have one foot in each of the boats that are parallel? The Haudenosaunee replied, if this so happens that my people may wish to have their feet in each of the two boats, there will be a high wind, and the boats will separate, and the person that has his feet in each of the boats shall fall between the boats, and there is no living soul who will be able to bring them back to the right way given by the Creator, but only one, the Creator himself. And thus, they concluded their pact of friendship. The agreement recorded in the two-row wampum emphasizes a cultural and interrelational framework. The threat to these values is recorded in the story itself, that one of the two parties will interpret the relationship in consumptive terms, and instead of protecting the relation of autonomous equals, will attempt to absorb the other into the same, want to own a piece of their property, grab the rudder in the other's vessel. To put it differently, the story anticipates the complications that will occur when people in later generations cross over from one boat to the other and become confused about where they belong or what kind of deal they were signing. Richard Hill notes that, like any text, the two-row has been interpreted variously by contemporary Iroquoian folks. Some, for example, have suggested that if indigenous people want to enter the white man's vessel, then they pretty much sign over their Haudenosaunee birthright. They will lose their cultural values, suffer from a split mind, and not be able to make clear decisions. Some suggest that the two vessels carry the spirit of each people's ancestors, so there are spiritual and religious reasons not to attempt to steer each other's boats. The Thomas and Miller versions, the one that I'm citing here and that Richard Hill was referring to, take a milder view. Because of the long history of contact and exchange between Haudenosaunee and European cultures, it's now 500 years, Many Iroquoian people now live, whether they want to or not, in the white man's vessel. Consider, for instance, the domain of language, where the majority of Six Nations populace no longer speaks one of the original languages, with the result that concepts such as those presented in the Aderi Wizon Sera Kaswenta must be borne by the uncertain vessel of the English language. Thomas and Miller represent the Two-Row not as a document of absolute cultural separatism, but as one that suggests native people should retain a native value system no matter where they go. The chances of Haudenosaunee people staying in their own canoe have turned out to be very few, despite their having formalized Two-Row treaties at successive councils with the Dutch, then the French, then the British, then the Americans and Canadians between the 17th and 19th centuries. A history-defining catastrophe occurred when the British, with whom the Six Nations had formed a Two-Row understanding, broke into two warring parties in 1776. A large contingent of Six Nations warriors felt compelled by their history of friendship with the British to side with them against the upstart rebels during the Revolutionary War. The result was that they were literally burnt out of their homes and farms by vengeful American troops during the infamous Sullivan Campaign of 1779. After the Treaty of Paris in a few years later, which significantly failed to make any provision for the First Peoples whose land had been overtaken during the fighting, the Haudenosaunee negotiated with British commander Sir Frederick Haldimand for 1 million acres of land on both sides of the Grand River in what's now Ontario. The British colonial government acceded to this arrangement not only in recognition of the Haudenosaunee contribution as allies, but also to secure their support in case of further aggression from the Americans and their native allies. This land, however, was then whittled down to less than a tenth of its original size by confusing land leases and sales and by successive reductions enforced by British and then Canadian governments. Canada's observation of the Two-Row Agreement went from partial recognition to eventual outright rejection. Not too long ago, as late as 1909, the Deputy Speaker of Six Nations Confederacy Council received a letter of assurance from Canada's Minister of the Interior, Frank Oliver, in Ottawa, saying that they would respect Six Nations' right to govern themselves, basically a two-row recognition. It is the policy of the Canadian government, wrote Oliver, to recognize its relations with the Six Nations of the Grand River as being on a different footing from those of any of the other Indians in Canada. The Six Nations Indians of the Grand River came to Canada under special treaty as allies of Britain, and the policy of the Canadian government is to deal with them, having that fact always in view. The system of tribal government, which prevailed among the Six Nations on their coming to Canada, was satisfactory to the government at that time, and so long as it is satisfactory to the Six Nations themselves, so long it will remain satisfactory to the government of Canada. 15 years later, 1924, Canada had abandoned the two-row policy when the Canadian government sent a detachment of armed RCMP officers to forcibly close the traditional government of the Six Nations on the Grand River and insist that the Haudenosaunee submit to the Indian Act with its Ottawa-controlled band council system. The chances of staying in their own canoe have been diminished not just by warfare, not just by residential schools or other legalized interventions. More and more recently, they have been challenged not only by the kinds of language loss that I have gestured towards, but also the saturating power of things such as television and the internet. These circumstances have raised the two-row for re-readings by contemporary Haudenosaunee artists and writers. Consider, for example, Mohawk artist Ellen Michelson's Two-Row Two, a large 13-minute video installation that presents panoramic video shots of each bank of the Grand River in two parallel rows, just like the Aderi Wizon Sera Goswenta. This is shot separately through a purple filter from moving boats. The two banks seem to flow by in opposite directions on the huge screen. These images are accompanied by a soundtrack that superimposes a Canadian cruise boat captain's English narration about the river onto narratives in their own language by Haudenosaunee elders. The confusion of overlaid voices and the disorientation of having the land rather than the river appear to move and in opposite directions highlight the complexity inhabited by the Grand River communities both on the reserve side and, quotes, the white side of the river to this day. The racial division of the two communities by the river is not the ideal conveyed by the Aderi Huizon Serra, Goswenta. The two vessels were to remain independent, but they were to share the river, not divide it. How long can two communities live in harmony on such a divided river when they are administered by a government that has taken over administration of both boats and done so in remarkably unequal ways? Do the stories of the cruise boat captain and the Haudenosaunee elders hear one another? Or are they each speaking separate stories that are obliterated by each other's noise? Over 20 years earlier, Tuscarora visual artist, historian, and curator Jolene Rickard, a professor in the art department at Cornell University, produced a photo collage called Two Canoes that reads the Aderi Huizon Serra Goswenta with similar questions in mind. In this work, Rickard presents the image of two tree trunks growing side by side in the same soil, but the feet of the two tree trunks are replaced by the feet of a moccasined groom and a European bride. Rickard says that the title comes from her grandfather, who always said that the Indian canoe is too swift for white culture. You had to decide which way that you were going to go. The photo of the bride and groom, she says, was taken at the wedding of a white woman who is very into her colonial background, I'm quoting her, and an indigenous man who is also very into his past. The bride is dressed like a 19th century woman, while the man is dressed for the present, and his natural, traditional, but still commonly worn moccasins contrast with her artificial, pointed, and fashionable shoes. Rickard's collage asks many questions about how to think two-row principles in our times. What is the relationship between nature and human culture? How long can two trees grow side by side in the same ground, cross-pollinating and intertwining their roots before they blend into some kind of hybrid? Is it reasonable and workable to expect people to share the same community for hundreds of years and for them not to eventually cross over into each other's vessels? Why do we, determine what is traditional and what is modern, the canoe or the sailing vessel, the moccasin or the laced and heeled shoe? Which culture is ahead or fast? Which culture is slow or behind? It's significant to note that while these works by Michelson and Rickard pose these far-reaching philosophical questions in the techniques and media of contemporary art, they do so in the iconography of the two-row. You have to know something of Six Nations history and tradition to plumb this meaning. If these artists are working and producing their work in the sailing vessel of the contemporary art world, they nonetheless produce these works out of the traditions of that canoe. Onondaga painter and poet Eric Gansworth puts these considerations overtly in the poem that's up on the screen. Gansworth notes that you can read this poem vertically, keeping the two rows separate, or you can read it horizontally, across the two rows, your eyes following the conventions of English orthography, which flows from left to right. Whichever way you read it, the sense of the poem is made from Haudenosaunee knowledge and history, even if it circulates in the world of literary publication outside the Iroquoian canoe in the English language. You need to know the three sisters refer to corn, beans, and squash, the three complementary food plants cultivated for millennia by Iroquoian peoples. You need to know not only the iconography of the Aderi Huizon Serra Goswenta itself, but also the subsequent history of how the question of purity versus racial and cultural mixing have become increasingly loaded for Haudenosaunee communities and their neighbors. The Aderi Huizon Serra and Goswenta is a visual of the paradox of reading, that activity in which one can reach across the fence between oneself and the world without destroying what one finds. It is an image of simultaneous interdependency and independence, of accommodation and autonomy. The white rows do not constitute negative space, for their three rows of three beads distinctly represent the three principles of peace, friendship, and respect that bind the two purple rows to one another. Rather than negative space, then, we might think of the white rows as constituting what Cree philosopher Willie Ermine calls ethical space. Ermine suggests that when two unequal parties enter into dialogue, the imbalance of power between them usually scuttles the possibilities for understanding. The beliefs and views of the dominant group tend to assert themselves as universal, and the beliefs and views of the subordinate group will be filtered through them. The resulting institutionalized monoculture, Ermine explains, and I'm quoting him here, creates the unfounded belief that there is a consensus about society and that the status quo of indigenous Western relations is the norm in this country. This norm becomes so embedded that the danger exists of a society believing that the social inequities and dominant subordinate relationships between human communities are authored under the laws of nature or that they're the will of God. End of quote. This is the history of Indigenous and Euro-Canadian dialogue. Euro-Canadian languages, protocols for argumentation, ways of ordering knowledge, and legal structures have bulldozed Indigenous ones in our public culture. Whether through the evacuation of Indigenous languages and beliefs through, quote, civilized education delivered in residential schools, through the outlawing of ceremonies from the sundance to the potlatch, or through the removal of Indigenous people from traditional lands and therefore their capacity to protect those lands from abuse, Euro-Canadian values and systems of knowing have entertained little reciprocity with Indigenous ones. The Haudenosaunee, to return to our immediate example, were welcomed as allies of the British and given land as equals during the Loyalist migrations at the end of the Revolutionary War, but they were pretty much immediately subsumed to the dictates of the Royal Proclamation, which asserted that all negotiations with native peoples over land must be brokered by the Crown. The universalizing reach of British law commandeered their canoe, even in the moment when the two parties were trying to negotiate a partnership, not between conqueror and conquered, but between allies. So the dialogue was not a dialogue. It rarely has been. Ermine argues that we need to take a step back from this assumed universalism and create ethical space by the, and I'm quoting here, it's on the PowerPoint, the unwavering construction of difference and diversity between human communities. These are the differences that highlight uniqueness because each entity is molded from a distinct history, knowledge, tradition, philosophy, and social and political reality. With the calculated disconnection through the contrasting of their identities and the subsequent creation of two solitudes with each claiming their own distinct and autonomous view of the world, a theoretical space between them is opened. This is not an argument for permanent cultural separatism. It is an argument for clarification and respect. As signaled by Jolene Rickard's White-Shoed Bride and Moccasined Groom, by Michelson's overlaid voices of the tour boat camp captain and the Haudenosaunee elder, and by Gansworth's cross-pollination, Ermine affirms that the long history of socio-political entanglement has created what he calls an irritable bond between settler and Canadian and Indigenous communities, whose result is a transcultural confusion at its worst, I'm quoting him here. We are now so badly entangled in our political and social lives that the principles of our existence as autonomous human communities have become blurred in that intercultural confusion. We no longer know what informs each of our identities and what should guide the association with each other. End of quote. Essentially, Ermine is suggesting that we all need room to breathe. For true dialogue to occur, all parties need to back away from coercive assertions of common ground that engulf and absorb the other, so that we can know what the other is actually saying. The idea of the ethical space produced by contrasting perspectives of the world, Ermine explains, entertains the notion of a meeting place where we can detach from the cages of our mental worlds and assume a position where human-to-human dialogue can occur. We've returned to paradox. When you take the other's otherness away, Robert Bringhurst writes, the other's sameness and humanity go too. The paradox is that a full recognition of the autonomy and uniqueness and life of the other requires that we not coerce the other into the category of the same. We cannot try to incorporate the other within our own existing systems of thought, our own cultural formulations and understandings, if we are to respect the other as a human being. The same is true if we are talking about nature. according the other, respect means valuing the otherness of the other for itself, valuing its difference just as we value ourselves for our own uniqueness. This kind of valuing requires the paradox of similarity and difference, of finding the similarity in unassimilated difference, the universal and the divergently particular. All life deserves care and respect, but each life is distinct and unique, and must not be stripped of its distinction if it is to be what it is. For this reason, instead of common ground, we need uncommon ground. To build uncommon ground, we need to read away from rather than toward the self. Rather than importing the signs of the other into our existing frameworks in order to find value in them, we need to engage actively and attentively to the frameworks that are foreign to us, not neglect them as incommensurable. We need to notice and learn from them, even as we remember that they are not our own. The reason to read away from the self and our familiar frameworks is not to push the other away, not to diminish or dismiss its value, nor that of the culture from which it emerged. Rather, we read away from ourselves so that we do not eat the other, do not reduce the other into serving merely as a foil for the self. We read away from ourselves in order to value the richness and fullness of the other as other, and therefore to go back to Bringhurst's paradox as the same. We read away from ourselves to turn private consumption into work that is publicly intellectual. If we as neighboring societies are to work towards respect, peace, and friendship, those three beads in the white central section, with each other as well as with the natural world in which we live, we need to learn how to build non-consumptive relationships with one another, and we need to rediscover two-role consciousness. So what can be achieved by reading the two-role wampum in the 21st century? And why have I taken as my example of non-consumptive reading this text from oral culture rather than from the long and rich tradition of written literatures? Didn't I begin by asserting that there is hope to be found in the act of reading? And isn't reading tied intimately to that particular tradition? To begin with the last two questions, it seems to me that we live in a period when the media we read are changing. More people read and write on screens these days than they do on books and paper, it seems. I'm not interested here in the red herring debates about whether book culture will survive and whether literacy in the 21st century is going to hell in a handbasket. What I'm interested in is the value there is in the act of reading itself, which paradoxically emphasizes vulnerable solitude and worldly interaction. Both ends of this paradox are about attentiveness. We go into solitude when we read, not in order to sink into our egos, but in order to pay closer attention to the voice of the other as we trace it on the page, on the computer screen, or on a 17th century ceremonial bead belt. By reading a 17th century oral document, such as the Aderivo Zonsera Gasuenta, I want to show that far-reaching philosophical and publicly crucial reading is not restricted to books nor to the Euro-American literary or philosophical canon. By tracing the history of interpretations of the two-row wampum from its formulation between the Dutch and the Iroquois in 1613 through to its recent re-readings in contemporary art and poetry, I haven't even touched on its many readings in political and legal debates, I have wanted to demonstrate that a rich tradition of reading and rereading exists around documents that emerge from oral cultures such as this. That tradition is far from dead. You can easily see it circulating today, not just in museums or your local library, or even on the internet. It's circulating in roadblocks to assert land claims, in editorial pages of a newspaper, and in ongoing government negotiations. From its inception, the two-row wampum was an intercultural document. It is literally about reading others across the lines of difference, about the value to be found in difference, especially for those who live together in the same environment. But what is the point of reading old historical texts such as the Aderivo Zonsera Gasuenta today? What hope can there be in reading documents like this that have been smothered by centuries of disavowal, dismissal, and willful ignorance? World-renowned psychoanalyst Julia Kristeva writes that her early childhood in communist-era Bulgaria gave her first-hand experience of the limitations in the idea of revolution. But this did not mean that she abandoned hope in social change. Rather, she says, it emphasized for her the etymology of revolt as revolving movement, and how it might be understood then as a return to the past and innovation, renewal of the self. In other words, a process of re-evaluation of the psyche. For substantial public change to take place, she suggests, we must engage the necessity of constant symbolic re-evaluation. For Kristeva, revolution can only take place when we return to the past and re-narrate its symbols and meanings for the present. Now, Kristeva is a psychoanalyst, so it's not hard to see that this approach to social change arises out of the mission of psychotherapy. The therapy works with the patient to re-narrate the troubled past so as to liberate the present from its toxicity and to release new freedom and self-realization for the future. Rereading the two-row wampum is not just a way to review what went wrong in the past between European newcomers and the Haudenosaunee. It's a way of rethinking the present relationship between the hungry self and the larger world. Not just between Europeans and First People, but between humans and the river itself, the watershed and the life it represents. To do this kind of revolutionary re-symbolization, we need to reconceive reading, the central activity of the humanities, in broader terms than we often do. We need to reinvigorate the traditional disciplines of mindful and alert interpretation that have been called close reading, the capacity to attend to the signs left by others, to consider their details and nuances, to bring our own experience of the world into dialogue with these signs, and see not just how they reflect what we know, but how they differ from and challenge what we already know. To realize the public intellectual potentials in this activity, however, we must be willing to challenge the boundaries of some of our traditional disciplines. We must expand from the idea that the most relevant texts are captured solely in the books and in books, and read a wider set of signs, from ink on a page or a computer screen, to quahog shells in a wampum belt, to the presence or absence of honeybees and songbirds in an ecosystem. We need to read these signs to reanimate their histories, so we can remember what has been suppressed or devalued, so they can be re-symbolized, and we can learn from the otherness we previously missed. We need to read for differences, not to push the world and others away from ourselves, but so that we can understand more clearly the nature of the uncommon ground which we share and on which our lives depend. In this way, we can learn to reach across the fence between ourselves and the world and not destroy what we touch. Thanks a lot for listening today.
Yesterday I read that Gayatri Spivak said, if you know a less taught language, that your obligation is to the scholars of the future to make that apparent. And so we have just seen Daniel do that, and so it's kind of neat to see that. So I'm sure you have questions or comments, and the floor is open now to speak with Daniel.
Would you say that relationship you sort of described there could apply as between people as well? Like I'm thinking as between the dialogue perhaps between men.
So between individuals you're thinking of? Willie Irvine takes this idea of ethical space and that dialogical scene from Roger Poole, and there's a photograph in Roger Poole's book that has it's during the Czech occupation, and there's a Russian soldier sitting on a bench, and he's looking at his interlocutor on the bench, who is a Czech citizen, and what Roger Poole is paying attention to is the space between these two and saying what kind of dialogue is possible. So it's formulated from the idea of the individual in the first place. And it seems to me that your example of thinking it in terms of, say, gender relations puts it, emphasizes the kind of differentials between whoever's in a dialogue, right? And that's one way of seeing, well, here's certainly what kind of language is shared. And is this a universal language, which it often appears to be, we're all speaking English? And what are the subtle forms of enfoldedness or coercion that occur when you're being forced into a language that's not your own? So certainly you can see how that kind of thing.
I guess the question that would arise then is what would be the difference if you might want to be aware of the aware of or look for between dialogues as between collectives and those that might take place?
That's a good question, yeah. That's a good question. I think Willie Ermine's elaboration of this concept is he took it from that kind of scene into a communal one, and it's remarkable that he did in the sense that, you know, a huge philosophical gap between Western cultures and their approaches to things are about it, the idea of being an individual and being a collective, right? And that's to him, the idea of saying this is only about individuals just seemed like an unnatural exclusion, right? So you can see that that is part of his instinctual move, taking from a European philosophical text and saying, hey, but I want to think this in a different context. So, yeah. Thank you. Yes?
I really enjoyed your talk, and I'd like to hear a little bit more about how your project could begin within specific historical circumstances. Because when you were talking, it occurred to me that it means something different for some communities to read away from the self than for others. Because in a way, reading away from the self has been a tool of colonization, right? And so to enter into this framework to think about reading away from the self has bigger stakes or has bigger risks for some people over others. So I guess at the heart of the question is, who's to read?
Yeah.
Who has to rethink this?
This is a great question.
How do we navigate that space from within the conditions that we have? Mm-hmm.
I guess an assumption about the we has been, I'm speaking in a university context, whereas there's a long tradition, there's, you know, of having inherited a European form of study and so on, and its canons and so on of knowledge. And so my assumption about reading away from the self is a reading away from our familiar tradition. For those who have been enabled and legitimized within that tradition. Now, there's lots of people who are unequally placed within any kind of tradition, right? University culture would be the same, too. Now, you were saying, how about the more historical specificity of these things? I guess the best way to talk about that is my own trajectory, which is that I taught at the Saskatchewan Indian Federated College back in the 80s, and I had considered working in the field of Indigenous literatures at the time, and then other things came along. Studied more immigration and diasporic writing when I was here. Then moved to Hamilton, where I was working in the field of Canadian literary studies. And right about the time that I had finished the project on whiteness in Canada, the land claim at Six Nations, right on the border of Six Nations territory and Caledonia town, took place in February 2006. And I was supervising, one of the people whose PhD projects I'm involved with as a supervisor was writing a literary history of Six Nations at the time. And that the land claim really was an extremely catalyzing event in our whole region. It was three months after the land claim began, just started by a few young women, and then it grew and grew and grew. The police raided, the Ontario Provincial Police raided with 200 police, armed with M16s, tasers, the whole business. It was incredible. And guess where they were housed? At McMaster University. They were staying in the residences and driving out to Caledonia to participate in this attempt to suppress a land claim negotiation. And I really felt at the time, I can't just not pay attention anymore. And this has to do with the history of my discipline, where concerns about white academics becoming experts in Indigenous knowledges and cultures were so heated in the 1990s during the cultural appropriation debates and so on. I had felt that this was a field that was a really difficult area to be in, but when that land claim took place, I thought, you know, that you just can't pretend that this isn't part of the environment in which I'm living, and how will we start to develop a richer dialogue around these things? The two-row is fascinating. It's so remarkable because there are many documents that should be internal to a community. They're interpreted in a certain ceremonial framework and so on that should remain inside that cultural domain. But the two-row is explicitly about relationships between these meeting parties. And I thought, I've got to work with this this document as it is. And so that's kind of a more historicized sense of where does this kind of a project come from? And who is the we? And what kinds of we's are involved? Because as you can see from that narration, there's lots of Indigenous scholarship happening inside the university framework in various kinds of levels of tension and satisfaction, and so that those are tensions in which this thing about ethical space really, really registered for me.
So if I could ask a follow-up question, yeah. Then would you say that from the vantage point of the First Nations community, that the imperative in your theoretical paradigm would be to read away from yourself in the same way? I mean, would you enter into the dialogue with a different kind of way of thinking about what that dialogue looks like?
Well, it seems to me that one of the things there is that the history has been a requirement to read away from the self,
right,
for a long time in that particular. If you were told you can't use your own language, your own culture, your own past, these are not civilized forms, then the urgency of reading away from the self is very different. So.
First of all, just thank you for acknowledging territory in the way that you did, and thank you for encouraging us to expand the kinds of reading that we're doing. And I guess my question in some way follows up on Matt's. It seems to me that reading in the way that Bringhurst describes it is not only about a fear of consuming, but a fear of being consumed. And that leads a lot of us to kind of, you know, read books rather than going to places and talking to people who might scare us or accuse us of things or involve us again in the 1990s cultural appropriation debates, these kinds of questions. And I just, I wonder to what extent we can reach that kind of uncommon ground that you're talking about while still being governed by this kind of process of reading that really privileges a very secondhand kind. So I'm wondering, maybe it's just a question about the term. I love the way that you've used it, and others have strategically sort of encouraged us to see literacy in other places. And I just wonder, is it at some point going to start to restrict us as well, having the kind of scholarship that we do?
It's a good, yeah. You guys don't ask like easy questions.
Those are the easy ones.
Oh, those are the easy ones? The better ones are even. Okay.
Well, I will ask you to plug here later on.
Okay, well, that's good. I guess a couple of things. This kind of work needs to, if it's to be read away from the self, it's also read away from the familiar, and that means in contexts that are not comfortable and that are listening or reading in a completely different framework. So they need to be in communities and with people and not just behind a kind of a one step removed. So that's comment one. I kind of challenge the idea that reading is always secondary and a step removed. I'd like to think that through with you a little bit, but it seems to me that in Gansworth's poem, for example, he's taking a traditional form, generating it in this poetic discourse that's very familiar to many of us. And is this now removed somehow? Is this now a step away? You know, I think that there's a kind of immediacy to that exchange that I think is really valuable. And then the artworks as well. You know, you think about how those are produced and so on. So if the part of your point was, well, let's meet people, not just texts, well, very true. And that really needs to be done. I think, too, that this is from just working with, there's an Indigenous Knowledge Center that I work with in Six Nations, and the concerns within the culture about who knows the stories of our culture anymore and how are they being recorded and how do we preserve these has turned into what? An archive project, right? And so we're all working on digitizing things that to make them what? Immediate, right? Make them close. And make them lively and relevant and available rather than, so the role of the literary and the textual and stuff like that is I would say not as simply a step removed as it might seem on our first glance.
You're going to moderate so I get to ask a question. The great law of Mohawk people was on a staff still there. But that's not the same as this, as the two rope. Sometimes one of the things that happens is that people imagine Six Nations as this harmonious group, and especially around contact. And it wasn't true. It was never true, and it surely isn't true now. So I wonder if you could comment on the problem of reading between the people who are inside of the Confederacy.
Yeah, well, because we're far away from that territory, I don't know how much people know of the background there. But so I mentioned that there were the Six Nations formed in the Confederacy under the Great Law. Probably people associated with the Mohawk Nation have been kind of famous across Canada. But so it is Six Nations who have distinct languages and different cultural traditions. But beyond that, with the insistence that Six Nations fall under the Indian Act, there's been a division between folks who maintain loyalty to the Confederacy system, the ancient governing system, and the Ottawa-controlled kind of band council, Ottawa-oriented band council system, and so on. And so there are many, many internal divisions, political, cultural, linguistic, and so on. And so talking about, it seems to me that one of the things to just observe right away is that that's why you would imagine such a confederacy to say, two-row is a natural way to think. To think of an autonomy and together model was precisely what was being managed by the Great Law all those years. So no wonder they thought of the two-row when the Dutch arrived and stuff. They had lots of experience with making confederations, right? And those tensions are just as I was tracing in the relationship between the Dutch and the Haudenosaunee, or Canada and Britain and so on, are also internal. You can see those being played out in the questions about how you make two row in Michelson's or Rickard's work.
The two row looks neat, but when you look at the edges, it's all frayed, and I think that's on purpose.
It's fringed, yeah.
Yeah, it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any comments just off the top of your head, you've experienced life, I guess, in Hamilton, by the sounds of it, you've experienced here, and my culture's language from those places. But there's the two-row from that area, and then there's the task here. Mm-hmm. Do you have any comments to mind about
I have to say that I'm not really well informed about kind of the concepts behind things like Wetaskiwin and so on, and Cree philosophy here. So I'm not really well versed in. I mean, I was saying earlier that my own story of kind of attention has been generated by living in the territory I'm in and its kind of demands. So I've been trying to get up to speed. And I wasn't so much up to speed when I was living here in Edmonton. So one thing I should say is that I referred lots to Willie Ermine's work. And, you know, attention within Indigenous studies more generally and Indigenous literary studies as well is between a kind of tribal specific practice which attends to the very local context in which knowledges and cultures and so on are produced. So major scholars are working on Cherokee literary history, not like Native American, this or that, right? But there's also a whole debate about cosmopolitan Native American studies as compared to kind of local, focused on the particular language or cultural group studies. And those, I think, are both telling and helpful. I mean, on the sense that I see huge parallels between what Willie's talking about with Earth, ethical space, and the two-row. But these were formed in completely different environments, different kind of conceptual time frames and time zones. So seeing a resonance between them, you can see how the kind of overlay of Euro-Canadian and Indigenous contact has generated similar considerations and questions and theoretical needs in these different environments. But, you know, they're going to be quite specific to their own ecologies. One of the
people who is being hugely influential in my reading recently is Sargej Henderson from the Native Law Center in Saskatoon. And he and Marie Batiste talk lots about the ways in which knowledges are based in ecologies, and indigenous knowledges are based in these particular ecologies. And I can sure see that from what I've learned about Haudenosaunee ways of seeing and thinking. The Cree ones and the Assiniboine ones from here will be related to this topography and its needs in the landscape generation too.
You mentioned Roger Kugler from tonight. I take it that's probably his book, Deep Subjectivity,
yes, yeah,
which is a work of, as you know, of phenomenology. And so this is not a criticism at all, but I'm just thinking that the method of reading that you talk about, that comes out of him in part, and he in turn, I think, was drawing on thinkers like Martin Buber and his work on dialogism earlier in the 20th century. And as I'm sure, as you obviously must know, this way of thinking, to my mind, very regrettably, has sort of fallen out of fashion academically in the last few decades. So I wonder if you would care to perhaps be more explicit in your defense of what is basically an older model of reading.
More explicit in my defense of an older model of reading. I mean, in a way, I think making a case for reading is kind of old school already. You know, to start in that place, I felt when I started the project In Bed with the Word that I was living in a time where I didn't think we could assume reading would be a value, and that new generations would say, yeah, reading's really important to me, and so on. So I thought, it's time to rethink this. Why do I teach literacy and reading? Why do I think it still matters? There are so many other forms of communication, and so on. So that's what got me started. And in a way, it was an old school impulse. And that then led me into thinking about, well, what are the spiritual disciplines and traditions out of which kind of Western literary hermeneutics came, and so on. And I guess the impulse that was in me there was to think about how does that older tradition remain significant and important in cultural politics in a broad sense now, rather than thinking of it in terms of an aesthetic practice or even a only scholarly one. And so that got me to thinking about the importance of attentiveness in short attention span times and ADHD culture, and the importance for me of other kind of terms that come out of spiritual practice, like mindfulness. And I guess, older forms of thinking were already part of my trajectory in this project. Then when I came across Willy Ermine, I saw him using that in a very, to me, very urgent part of what's still not just not going away in Canadian cultural life, but increasing in its urgency, and generates things like rock throwing between peoples in suburban Caledonia and folks at the reclamation site. So old school, it seems incredibly lively and relevant to me this time. So.
I kind of had two questions there. The one thing that kind of occurred to me as we talked about is sort of a two-row sort of model of reading into that model, is what happens when that becomes multi-dimensional in there, like, because there were several two-row trees. How does that expand? Does that change the dynamic in some way? And, you know, and then I was thinking also, you know, that in terms of the historical setting, like the land grant to the Six Nations was also taking land away from the Ojibwe.
Well, that's a tricky history around that.
Yeah, no, and obviously I'm not asking for an engagement with all of those details, but even just the multidimensionality of it, like, you have the Six Nations who, you know, you were saying they had a two-row tree Dutch and the British and various others. And so how does that thing, does that change anything, or is that an expansion waiting to happen?
This is a really good point, and in some ways it picks up on kind of the other side of the kind of question you were asking, Julie. And I think, I'm not going to start elaborating rows. What I would like to say about that is that I guess I'm thinking about that white space. It's not negative space, it's about uncommon ground and about the recognition of differences and difference not as rejection or as you're different, therefore I'm not interested. Difference as relationship, right? And I think that that can be very multidimensional. And that's the history that you're pointing to, first the Dutch, then the points out that this was how it was conceived. And it came from a people who were not singular on their side in their canoe either. So it has a model for saying, well, there is a dialogue. It emphasizes the dialogism. And then also at the same time is about elaborating rather than ignoring the kinds of difference that are between that exchange. I think that can be quite flexible rather than... I mean, there's the beauty of the hermeneutics of the simple model. You can see it. You can keep it in your head. And that doesn't need to remain kind of simple or binary in its way of operation.
Yeah. Exactly. I was just sort of picturing a network of interactions that are always...
Yeah. Well, there's a whole... I mean, your comment also makes me think that wampum has so many forms. I mean, this is just a famous one that was formed between... that was explicitly about European indigenous relations. But there is circle wampum that have strings going out in multiple directions, and so the possibilities of mnemonic format are endless, it seems to me. So, yeah, good point.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. I'm trying to articulate the issue, but I think it has to do with the binary. You alluded to one point about the local, the change to the local, versus the cosmopolitan. And I have a sense that we sort of were, the universalizing reading. And when I think back to the contact you're talking about, there are different reading practices. I guess the other part of it is reading is a very material thing. So the part of my concern, and I think others about the Brinkhurst, is that reading is, from another perspective, not non-consumptive. It's very consumptive, right? I mean, whether it's the trees or other, that are used to produce books, I was at a conference, presenting next to a person who is an expert in, programmer and computing. He's quite convinced that Kindles, that e-readers are going to become so cheap and not produce in the future, they'll be disposable. And we already have, so there's that kind of consumption, but there's also the fact that I was very struck last year, Alice Major, the poet that he talked about, her father, who's a painter, and he would paint houses while he was painting, write poems on the walls and then paint over them. Right? I mean, that the ability of some people to read, to be public and to read and think, rests upon the work of other people who don't have that time and energy, so I guess the question is about how much we can generalize about reading and the extent to which we can take reading and separate it out from the world as a whole in which we live.
I guess my thought about that is that you were kind of drawing our attention to the materiality of the objects that are coming. Would you all remember that these books are for sale? The materiality of the objects, and that we can consume them. And that,
that can happen on this physical level of paper and electronic. It can also be in the kinds of colonizing meetings that take place. Other people's knowledge become ours and owned by us and so on. I have no quibbles with those kinds of understandings of the practice, but remember that my point was to say, how do we find hope in a time where we despair about not being able to get outside of the circle of consumption? And what are the activities that we try to say, well, this is a generous activity, it's a contributory activity. And I think we could be talking about listening and human interactions as well, but it's what I'm trying to get at is the ways that we can take deep interest in the words and concepts and lives of others without eating them, without making them into property and patented products of our own. And reading is one of the ways that many people experience that. Right? There's ways that we do learn incredibly from someone else, the way that they understood the world and so on, without destroying them. You know? And that richness remains after our learning and so on. And it is a mutual gifting. And that's what I'm after. I guess that was pretty clear, but it seems to me that you can read these things. This is, I got reading in the brain. So you can read these things from either side of the practice, right? And it's after that generous impulse and that opening impulse, which is where the reading away from the self comes from the same place.
And just a brief one, I have no quarrel with the finding of with the attempt at time hole, but I do. That's good. but I do quarrel with the step that wants to remove reading from the other activity. Well, that's the point, and I won't change more, but that to me is the key point, right? And I'm not saying that, I think that's where we have to put, press, go back to your, what was it, camera, your document camera. That's the point that I would push on.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, I think your quibble is more with me than Bringer, because Bringer says that he wants to see it in the activity of eating and being eaten, reading and being read. He talks about that world of consumption that takes place. Yeah. I'm the guy who wanted to find some hope in there. and it is because I have some faith in that, the generosity of that impulse.
Well, thank you for your indulgence, January, and more matter with it.
You did talk about reading away from itself, and it's a marvelous idea, and there are so many new ideas that I've been used in front of them. But let me ask one question. The self. The self doesn't remain the same. And if you are seriously reading, at the end of it, you're a different self in some way. How does that incorporate? Maybe those two purple strips are starting to turn red or green.
Now we're into my temptation, which is always to kind of elaborate the metaphor. So reading away from the self, keep going, follow it. Don't just stay back there, right? If you're reading away from the self, there's a following and a learning from it. So you're not a stable self sitting in one place. And these arrows that go out into the experience of the other, while this remains sacrosanct and undisturbed. No, that's precisely what I'm saying, is that reading transforms the self, and that should be kinetic, not anchored. Thank you.
I was just thinking about the students that I taught at the junior high level, who reading was always going to be very difficult for them. They were kids whose brains would make that a reality, in a lot of ways, no matter what kinds of interventions occurred. And so for me, that the text of conversation and dialogue was a way to communicate and expand a way of being together in community, much more than text that was on a page could ever or would ever do. And when we think about the reading level, even generally in the population, and, you know, the supposedly having to write to the grade 4 or the grade 5 equivalent reading level, and thinking about how your vision of being with the other and being in dialogue with otherness, I wonder if it can transcend text that outside of the university setting, or outside of at least some of society's weakness that I think may not be able to change in some circles around mediating text or even being comfortable with words. And I don't mean to say, I'm not trying to, people will say, oh, yeah, the schools don't do a good enough job, that's the problem. Well, I'm speaking about the folks really that reading is going to always be very, very difficult for, I guess. So what do you see when you say, can we read the bees and what they're telling us? And even the long poem was outside of the words on a page, even when I know you're talking about it as text. So what's the text for us that's outside of the page as well?
Well, it seems some of the things you've said suggest to me that they're in that classroom environment already, right? You're talking about the way some of those students have responded really well to conversation and to story. Would they be like reading out loud story? Or so there's ways in which that experience can be understood in beside the framework. Like, you know, I was talking about the individual by himself in the book and so on, that kind of model. But we have this experience in different parts of our lives. There's different ways, you know, people have that with a photograph. People have that capacity to attend carefully to elements of nature. I guess you could tell me, you'd be more experienced than I would. And that's about celebrating and enabling that experience so that it becomes something that learning child or young person feels like, this is growing me. It's growing me beyond the self that I thought I was. Right? So the one who was always limited, who couldn't do things, you know, who wasn't able to achieve academically and so on, and then finds, actually, I can. It might not be because I'm good in literacy, but it might be something else. So I think the two, you know, even showing these images is an example of that kind of reading practice. I'm calling it a reading practice because I'm a literature professor.
That's right. Well, you don't come to Edmonton without getting a workout.
I do not, that is true. And I'm in better shape.
No, look at you.
Okay, so please join me in thanking Daniel for coming.